This is the Heartland Daily Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Heartland Sioux Daily Podcast. I'm Sterling Burnett, Director of the Arthur B. Robinson Center on Climate and Environmental Policy and Managing Editor of Environment and Climate News. I'm pleased to have as a guest today a friend, former colleague, and one of the finest laborers in the field of liberty and energy sanity that I know, Isaac Orr. Isaac Orr is a policy fellow at the Center of the American Experiment, where he writes about energy and environmental issues, including mining and electricity policy, which is a lot like what he used to do as a research fellow at the Heartland Institute early in my tenure here. He's been a featured guest on Heartland's weekly Thursday In the Tank live stream multiple times. His research rarely exposes green energy boondoggles to the light of day, and that's what he's here to discuss today. Isaac, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Sterling. Good to be back.
Yeah. Wish we worked together more often.
Well, so, you know, you have my number. I can be on the show whenever you need me to be.
Well, I didn't mean just for the show. I just wish that we did some more research together.
Well, talk to the higher-ups at Heartland, and maybe we can make it work. How's that sound?
Okay. So, Isaac, before we jump into your current work, for our listeners who may not be familiar with you or the Center of the American Experiment, I mean, not everyone who listens today used to listen when you were on before, please give us a little bit about your background, your previous work, and how you came to work on energy and mining issues.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up on a dairy farm in Wisconsin, and that's kind of my formative experience, right? So when I was a kid and it'd be hot, there'd be, you know, days where the cows would be drinking so much water that it would draw down the pressure in the well. So I'd get done doing chores like cleaning pig pens or something, and we wouldn't have any water pressure in the house. So I couldn't take a shower, couldn't wash clothes or anything like that. So when I was in college, I was in my environmental geology class, and we were talking about groundwater pressure, wells, and hydrology and stuff like that, where I'm like, okay, this is really interesting. So I always knew I was going to go to school for political science, but then that's the point where I realized I liked the geology and kind of natural science aspect of it too. And there's tons of overlap in that, right? So I knew that there was going to be a good niche for me to carve out in kind of environmental policy moving forward. So then, you know, I worked for a state senator for a little bit. Listeners might be familiar with him. And then I worked at the Heartland Institute for a good number of years. And I've been at American Experiment since 2018. So yeah, kind of a long, strange trip. Can't believe I've been doing energy policy for like 11 years now. It just doesn't seem real.
Yeah. So, and what about the American Experiment? Tell them a little bit about that.
Yeah, for sure. It is a think tank in Minnesota. So it is a lot like, it's part of the state policy network. So Illinois Policy Institute, for some of the folks at home that are familiar with those state level think tanks. We cover a lot of different issues. We have a couple economists on staff that talk about regulation and taxes. We've got an education fellow. We've got public safety, so basically like crime, dealing with crime, and healthcare. So in addition to the energy and environmental policy work that we do there.
And just like Heartland, you don't just deal with Minnesota issues or regional issues. You look at some broader issues as well.
Yeah. Yep. Especially in the energy and environment section, we've been doing a lot of modeling on the impact of EPA regulations in different parts of the country. And we've been modeling different renewable energy mandates all over the country as well. So it's been really great. It's kept us very busy, though.
Yeah. You know, even if you were a state think tank, you purely wanted to work on state issues, the federal government impinges so much on state authority and policies. It's hard to separate the two sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely.
So before jumping into your recent publications, and I do want to get there, but recently there were some pretty big happenings. You might say things are booming at the American Experiment. With very little media attention, as far as I've been able to ascertain, the American Experiment's offices were firebombed. What do you know about it? Why do you think it's not getting more coverage, even in the local media, than it's gotten so far? I mean, I'm convinced myself that if this had been a liberal think tank that were firebombed, say the Center for American Progress or something like that, it would be front page news on the New York Times and Washington Post. I see nothing like that.
You know, in fairness, I do think that there would be a lot more pearl clutching if this had been a liberal think tank. I think it would have been bigger news. But in fairness to the local media, almost all of them covered it, some. And the Star Tribune, Minneapolis Star Tribune, which is kind of the big newspaper in town, wrote an op-ed saying, like, hey, maybe we shouldn't firebomb our political or our ideological opponents, right? So
maybe
the governor threw, I mean, they were more upfront about it than that. So I was being a little bit flippant. The governor tweeted out, hey, you shouldn't do this, which I appreciated, right? So there has been a lot of that. But essentially, we had some arsonists come through and try to burn down our offices. And there are three conservative organizations in our building. There's the Upper Midwest Law Center, which is a public interest law firm up on the third floor. There's a there's a group called Take Charge across the hall, which is, you know, primarily focused at African-Americans and getting them back into the conservative fold. And then our office, Center of the American Experiment. So they broke into Upper Midwest Law Center on the third floor, poured gasoline on the floor there, lit it on fire, ran downstairs, poured a bunch of gasoline in the hallway of in between our office and Take Charge, and then they bolted out the side door. So this was at like 2 a.m. on Sunday, January 31st, or whatever that weekend was, whatever the Sunday was. And you know, I got a text from my friend James, who works at the Upper Midwest Law Center, and he said the building got set on fire last night. And I just thought he was pulling my leg, basically trying to get a rise out of me. And then we got an email from the building saying, hey, yeah, there was a fire. And, you know, at first we thought maybe it was like somebody had a space heater plugged in or something like that. But then, you know, the FBI and the ATF got involved. So they're looking for the perps. Thankfully, the fire was largely contained to the hallway, and the damage to our personal stuff in there is mostly smoke damage with some water damage from the firefighters needing to use water to put the flames out, obviously. But, you know, that building is going to be totaled for the next year and a half, probably. They're probably going to have to gut it down to the studs and totally rebuild it. So, you know, thankfully, the stuff that I cared most about in there is probably going to be okay. It's going through, like, the insurance companies, like, putting everything through an ozone machine to try to get the smoke smell out. So, you know, it could have been worse, but it definitely kind of surreal to know that, like, maybe we triggered someone so hard that they set our building on fire.
Well, so there were multiple conservative organizations involved. I didn't know that. So
yeah,
it's not getting the coverage I think it merits, or it would have merited if the media was more, as they say, fair and balanced.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
But were there any cameras? Did y'all have cameras in the hall or at the entrance or anything? I know it's an ongoing case. Maybe you are in on the inside. I'm just wondering if there's any feeling that maybe the FBI and the ATF might be onto something.
Yeah, I think they will. There's a camera in our office that points towards the door, and it's just one of those little side, you know, those little windows that are next to doors frequently.
Yep.
We see them setting down like something. We assume it's a couple cans of gas, and then they go upstairs to light the law center on fire. So I don't know if there's great surveillance or was great surveillance in the hallways themselves, but we had some cameras, and, you know, they were the only car that was going down that road at the time that the arson happened, right? The alleged arson or suspected arson, whatever you want to do, whatever, like, types of qualifiers you want to put on
no
this.
No qualifiers.
Right?
But it was arson. They were arsonists.
And yeah, yeah. So to our knowledge, they have the FBI and the ATF have not caught them yet. We haven't had that kind of update yet. But we feel pretty confident because they were there was only one car on that road, and there's cameras on the road. Like, there's a gas station down the street and stuff like that. So we think, you know, justice will hopefully be served, but it hasn't yet.
Well, big news. You know, we had a little bit of of that ourselves at Heartland, but not nearly as extensive as what you've done. So it's really sad to hear it. I'm glad that nobody there was, you know, it was right time and not no one was injured.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of an off-the-wall theory, but it might have been my dog, because I think she's really enjoyed having me work from home for the last month or so.
How does she look in a hoodie and a face mask? Does she resemble yeah. those you saw in the camera?
Yeah, I haven't seen the footage, but, you know, like, where were you, Maple, on the evening of January 31st at 2 a.m.?
Why is that arsonist on four legs?
Mm-hmm.
So, Isaac, you recently wrote a piece titled three energy realities that renewable advocates can't answer, unquote. What are the realities and why can't they answer them?
Yeah. We noticed that if you put a number that's in a title, you get more clicks. So we definitely did a little bit of that. So the first one is, you know, renewables, wind and solar. I don't really like to call them renewables, but you know, it also makes
unreliables.
People
you should call them unreliables. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, they're totally dependent on subsidies. And when you bring that up to people, the supporters of these unreliable energy sources, they always say, "Oh yeah, well, what about the subsidies for fossil fuels?" And you know, the subsidies that they talk about are never actually subsidies. They're pretending that their own kind of made up externality costs for, you know, traditional air pollutants or CO2 are somehow a subsidy, when that's not what a definition of a subsidy is, right? A subsidy is a direct payment made by the government. And, you know, in many respects, by, you know, you do your accounting, and oil and gas are taxpayers, not net tax receivers. So we debunk that myth. The second myth is that wind and solar are cheaper than conventional sources of electricity generation, like coal, nuclear, and natural gas. And we kind of get into all of the hidden costs that levelized cost of energy estimates put out by Lazard don't take into account. Like, they don't take into the fact that you need more than just wind or solar in order to run a grid. You need batteries, or you need natural gas backup. And you should attribute that cost to the unreliable source that requires that backup, right? So once you do that, wind and solar are, it's way more expensive to run a grid using wind and solar than it is any other type of dispatchable power plant. But what they want to do is, when they do their LCOE analysis, and levelized cost of energy, for the folks at home who might not be familiar with that, is basically they try to figure out the cost of a certain type of power generator divided by the number of units of electricity it's going to produce over its lifetime. It's like the cost of driving a car on a per mile basis, right? So it's just kind of easy to think about it like that. And they're always using kind of cherry-picked assumptions to get really low costs for wind and solar, and then really high costs for coal, natural gas, or nuclear. So we go into that in the post a little bit. And then we also talk about how, you know,
before you move on from that.
Yeah.
You know, one of the cherry picked costs the numbers is, they say things like these last 30, so solar panels. Oh, they last 25 years. Well, not any real solar panel I've ever experienced. You know, if they get hit by hailstorms, they're gone. I don't know a coal plant that goes because it got hit by hail.
Right.
If they get dirty and you don't clean them regularly, they lose efficiency. If, you know, after 20 years, they lose efficiency regardless of whether they're cleaned or not. Wind turbines break apart not infrequently. They shed plastic. And so their operational lives are just, quite frankly, less than are often estimated, and their operation efficiencies are less than often, you know, estimated. I remember I went to a wind farm. I went to a Society for Environmental Journalists conference in Pittsburgh, and they had a field trip. We went out to a big wind farm there. Miles around, as far as the eye could see, you could see wind turbines on top of mountaintops. And I had flown with the PR people from the wind company. They didn't know who I was. I introduced myself. We were talking. They were a PR pump company for Reliant Energy. They had holdings up there in Pennsylvania. And they were saying, oh, yeah, we reached efficiencies of 32% this year. We're very proud, 32%. And so we get out there, and not a turbine is turning. All the power in Pennsylvania then is coming from, it turns out, nuclear in that region. And we asked the guy who actually managed the farm, the on-site guy. And he says, oh, we were very proud this year to reach 20% efficiency. 12% less than the PR people said, right?
Yeah, yep. And, you know, that's all kind of cooked into the books. So when Lazard does their numbers, they're generally looking at like a 45% capacity factor, which happens in some places, right? I mean, if you're talking about North Dakota, South Dakota, parts of Iowa, Oklahoma, Texas, nah, there's like one or two in Minnesota that does it. Like, it's not impossible, but it's also inappropriate to apply that generally to use cases in Ohio or Pennsylvania, right? So there's a lot of details that are devilish, and the least scrupulous renewable energy promoters never really look at those types of those thorny issues. So we like that. We like to dig into the weeds there and kind of expose people who are blowing smoke up your skirt. And the last issue that we looked at for this was reliability, right? As you add more wind and solar, you have less reliable capacity online, and then that ends in a blackout. So that happened in California. There, it was largely because the state is mandating the closure of reliable power plants and essentially, you know, requiring an increased dependency on things that may or may not show up to work when you need them to. In Texas, it's because ERCOT is probably the worst regulatory structure. An energy-only market just doesn't work if you have all of these wind and solar facilities that are highly subsidized by the federal government. It's just never going to work, and they need to change course over there. And then in Hawaii, you know, they passed legislation forcing the shutdown of a coal plant, and one of their state senators, I forget what her name was, but she was a Democrat from Hawaii, basically taking a victory lap saying, oh, we closed this coal plant and we didn't have blackouts, and then like 3 months later, there was a blackout. So, as you increase your focus on adding wind and solar, it becomes very expensive because it's like building a whole new system that only works if it feels like it. And at some point, there is a cost pressure, right? The prices increase because of that unreliability, and people don't like paying more for their electricity. So
paying more for less reliable power.
That's correct. Yep. So, and then companies start to cut corners, right? Maybe they don't do the maintenance on their peaker plants that they need to in order to keep the lights on, even though they're more important than they've ever been. Or maybe the utility commission says you can't build this new natural gas peaking station because it is an anathema to our climate objectives or something like
Let me ask you this. Can you imagine a power company succeeding if they were sort of honest about this? If they said, you know, here at Sterling's Power Company, we care about the environment. So you'll be paying more for less reliable energy. You know, how do you think Sterling's Power Company is going to do in that situation? I guess quite well in states where they, give me a monopoly. There's not much, right? You know, I can say whatever I want. We're burning down the planet here at Sterling's Power Company. By the way, we just went for a rate increase to do so.
Yep. We're shoveling puppies and kittens into the furnace as quickly as possible.
Yeah. Well, you know, there was a great Dilbert cartoon about a decade ago. I don't know if you know the characters of Dilbert, but he's got a dog called Dogbert.
Yeah.
And Dogbert is he's always got a scheme. And Dogbert says, here at the Dogbert Power Company, we run only green power. It's a renewable resource. And then they go to a big furnace, and they show this guy throwing a blanket with a body in there, and he says, we're running out of hippies. He says, we're running out of hippies. He said, just go get some more homeless people off the street.
Yikes.
So, in addition, you testified in Ohio about grid reliability. Now, Ohio, like Texas, is a Republican state. You'd think they'd figure this out. So what are the problems? I suspect they're the same that you identified above in the three questions. But what are the issues in Ohio, and how do they reflect problems nationwide?
Yeah, I mean, Ohio's actually really smart. I mean, they're one of the few states that said, we are going to classify natural gas as clean, right? So
there you go.
Ohio's big problem is New Jersey and Maryland, because, you know, we're all in this together when it comes to our electricity system, because, you know, in our part of the country, when I say our part, I mean the Eastern Interconnect, the U.S. electric grid is basically segmented into three different grids. It's the Eastern Interconnect, which is everything east of the Rockies, the Western Interconnect, everything west of the Rockies, and then you have ERCOT, which is, you know, Electric Reliability Council of Texas. So the Eastern Interconnect is split up into multiple regional transmission organizations, or independent systems operators. They're two terms for basically the same thing, that they're often used, those terms, interchangeably. So I'm just going to call them RTOs, right? So
Okay. You've
got Southwest Power Pool, which goes from North Dakota to New Mexico. You've got MISO, Mid-Continent Independent Systems Operator, which is 15 states stretching from Minnesota to Mississippi. You've got PJM, which is what Ohio was part of. And that's like Ohio, Pennsylvania, parts of Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, New Jersey, Maryland, and probably Delaware. I forget what all the states in PJM. It's probably the one I'm the least familiar with. And then you have ISO New England, which is the six New England states. So in Ohio's case, their biggest threat to grid reliability is the fact that blue states are shutting down their coal plants and possibly their natural gas plants prematurely, and not replacing them with reliable stuff in their wake, right? So, and the thing is, if New Jersey decides to shut down all of their reliable plants, and Maryland does too, they're going to be taking power from Ohio and Pennsylvania, which are, you know, two of the bigger states in terms of electricity generation. And they're going to try and use that in order to keep their own lights on. And because they're all part of this power pool, which is PJM, Ohio's problem will be, or New Jersey's problem will quickly become Ohio's problem. And we see that same phenomena in MISO, which includes Michigan, Illinois, and Minnesota, three states that have said we're going to be 100% carbon free. I think Michigan's was as crazy as 2035. All of these states are trying to outdo each other in their arrival date, even though it's all baloney. None of it's going to actually work out. Ultimately, that's what's going to happen. Ohio's either going to have to build enough reliable power plant capacity within its borders to shoulder the load for PJM, or figure out a way to, I don't know, segregate itself off from the rest of the market. And I don't even know if that's possible.
I was about to say, why? You know, look, they you do have all these regional transmission organizations. I don't think, however, They are a fairly recent vintage. There was a time not too long ago where every state ran its own power grid. And you may think there are inefficiencies in that. And, of course, you've already said that ERCOT has some problems. But the problem we don't have is that if Oklahoma were to go green tomorrow, and Arkansas and Louisiana and New Mexico as well, every state surrounding us, it wouldn't affect our power grid at all. We run our power grid. And so we're not dragged down. I don't see why Ohio, maybe it's illegal for them to extricate themselves from this. But it seems to me that a state would be smart not to to only align itself with other states of similar political and power profiles. You know, you want a reliable partner in your power system. And if there are states that aren't reliable partners, like New Jersey for Ohio or Michigan for and others for a variety of places, you wouldn't want to be part of their regional transmission organization. Maybe it's time to form a new one.
I mean, I don't know what the feasibility of that is. I don't know how these things form and dissolve. I think you're going to see more demand for that moving forward if reliability suffers as a result of state mandates for bad energy policy in other states.
I was about to say out-of-state mandates for bad energy policies affecting your state. That's what I'm saying. It's like, Texas did it. Texas has done it from the inception, and I don't think the RTOs are as old as ERCOT. I can't see legally why Ohio couldn't and wouldn't want to extricate itself from a system where your partners are going to undermine you and impose cost on your residents. You're not beholden to New Jersey. You know, your politicians, the Ohio politicians, aren't beholden to the residents of New Jersey, and they shouldn't be held hostage by them.
Yeah. It's just that all the interregional transmission lines are already built, so I don't know how easy or hard it would be to actually limit the electrons from flowing outside the border of your state. I've never really thought about it before. It's something to think about, I guess.
But our transmission lines, Texas's transmission lines don't stop at the border. What it is where the electricity sales are, because it's not just that the electricity goes, it's where you can or do sell your power to on the wholesale market. That's what they really were created to do, to operate the wholesale market for power. So it seems to me you could just say, sorry, we generate this much power, and it's from these sources, and we're not selling it into your market. Unless you pay us a lot more.
Sure. For a price, we'll sell it. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting concept. I don't know the specifics of it, so I don't feel like I should speculate.
Well, and I'm not an engineer, so I don't know either. I'm just trying to think outside the box how, because people say, oh, well, Texas has its problems because they're not connected to other states.
thank goodness they're not, because you would have drug us down with you during Uri. I mean, MISO had very close to blackout conditions in 2021 in MISO South, but say Texas was connected to MISO North during Uri, we would have had blackouts. You would have taken more power from Southwest Power Pool. You would have taken power from MISO, and your blackouts would have been less bad, but we would have had to help share the burden, right?
Is Oklahoma part of MISO?
Oklahoma is part of Southwest Power Pool.
Well, we probably would have got ours from Southwest. It probably wouldn't have affected you.
Well, the problem is Southwest Power Pool also had blackouts during that time period. So
so what you're saying is no system operator really managed things well during Uri.
I mean, PJM and MISO did well. I'm just saying that
PJM, though, wasn't affected really by Uri.
Sure. All I'm saying is Texas is in its own special kind of mess, and the policymakers there are kind of nibbling around the edges, and they're not getting to the heart of stuff.
I agree. I've written about it multiple occasions. They've got the same problems in Texas created a completely weird and different way.
Yeah, they just love California energy policy, but they put a cowboy hat on it.
Well, it wasn't that. You know, we went to – well, it's a longer story. We made a deal with the devil when we got power-electricity competition. We brought in electricity competition. It worked well for the first few years when we weren't reliant on renewables. But then we subsidized – we mandated a certain amount of renewables, and we helped subsidize the rest of it. And it screwed us up to no end.
Yep.
So, Isaac, I had another question, but you've really answered that question already.
Yeah, I saw that.
So, it's been good to speak with you again today. I wish we were in contact more often. Until we talk again, I want to thank you for coming on the show on behalf of myself and our listeners.
Hey, thanks for having me, Sterling. Appreciate it.
Listeners, thanks for checking in on us today. Please check Heartland's website as we continue to follow the work of Isaac Orr and the other great researchers at the Center of the American Experiment. And let's hope that they and other organizations like them aren't
attacked by,
aren't attacked by terrorists again in the future. Also, continue to follow us as we track the progress of energy and environmental laws and regulations that affect you. And if you're not already receiving these podcasts daily on your favorite device, go to iTunes and subscribe. When you have the time, please rate our podcast on iTunes so you can help us expand the reach of free market ideas. You might also check out our weekly Climate Change Roundtable live stream every Friday, soon to be retitled Climate, what's it going to be called? Climate Realism Live or something like that. I think the retitle is this Friday. So listen in. It's going to be on the same bat channel, same bat time. Every Friday on your favorite social media streaming device, where Anthony Watts, Linnea Lucan, and myself, and almost weekly guests, discuss the climate topics of the week, complete with taking questions from viewers. Thanks. Take care. Bye.